The same things I heard when I first sat down on my first Vipassana retreat that inspired me are still inspiring me now. It's just as if that which I heard is coming closer in relevance and application in my life. And as well, some of the mythology or the history that I heard and then heard again and again, because we do hear over and over. Fortunately, we have teachers who stay close to the teachings and offer them over and over again. Because within these teachings and within a range of certain mythology, meaning that we don't really know what's true, but this is a story that comes with the tradition, and as well commentary, older commentary, sometimes not so much modern commentary, there's just this repetition over and over again. We hear it again, and we hear again that this entire opportunity that we have for hearing the teachings and engaging the associated practices is because of a sensibility born of an understanding and a being that we did not know we were suffering. And the sensibility comes out of compassion. Oh, that willingness to recognize that we arrive with certain conditioning that if we have good fortune, becomes the basis of our inspiration to cultivate the Dhamma. Because our conditioning does not manifest a lot of clarity. But we can become clear. Again, another discernment of the distinction between the condition process and the intentional process, what we choose to cultivate. So in that sense, we experience all the states, the afflictive states. And when we begin to develop more equanimity, there's the recognition, oh, that this is common to all beings, as opposed to what we really appreciate in the beginning, that we hear that it's not just me that experiences depression or anger or ill will towards myself and others. But this is a universal in the conditioning that comes with life and into life. And it's very helpful to hear the humanity of people that we revere and might want to dream about. Dalai Lama, who talks about being human and about the challenges of being human and the challenge of anger and how he works with it. He says, yes, anger exists. I just don't engage in identification with it. What does that mean? Well, that means that, yes, the truth of suffering, of anger, exists, but he has learned that he can engage mindful awareness. He has learned and maintains the initial suggestions, instructions that we are engaging here and now, so that there's a considerable amount of equanimity that allows for a way of viewing suffering without identifying with it. He says that one of his challenges in this life is that his own people are suffering because of him, because they are angry and he won't join them in their anger. And that he refers to the middle path, which does not engage extremes. And so the youth of the Tibetan culture who feel they want their land back and the Chinese are bad and, you know, want to get in there with aversion and and they want to fight. And there's huge movements of anger within the Tibetan community. You know, we've been too passive, we haven't done anything. And the Dalai Lama says, the truth is within the suffering that we're experiencing inner desire to retaliate. This is the, these are the teachings. These are the teachings. And we can always move back into retaliation and find out what that's like. But retaliation, and that natural experience that we have when we feel as if we have somehow been unfairly treated or mistreated, or that there's been some cause that has brought about suffering, that first instinct, if you catch it, is retaliation. I shared with, I think it was here that I shared that somebody honked at me. Did I say that? Not, probably not. But, you know, maybe it was probably in Santa Fe. Somebody honked at me as I was turning in to go up the hill to the sendo there. And it hurt. The honk hurt. The hearing of it hurt. You know? And so there was a rapid kind of duel of, I don't know what I did wrong that someone honked at me. I want to get back at them. But it was just like, do-do-do, you know, like that. Whereas some people would have pulled out of that driveway, headed after that car, honked that person into utter oblivion, maybe gotten out, or sometime, like one time like somebody did with me, run their car in front of me, so I stopped my car, come to the door, insist I get out. I didn't get beaten up. But, you know, I mean, it could go on and on. You honked at me. You honked at me. Do you understand why it is that I'm going to murder you? And it's like that, and we can follow it within ourselves. It's a lot of, oh dear, fun to kind of catch those moments where there's an experience of something that hurts, and then literally experience the proliferation of associations and states that become bound together, in which suddenly there is an unconscious, you know, karmic action. These are all karmic actions, but, you know, to the degree that the violence occurs. I've enjoyed experiencing anger, you know, and in other words, if I'm in a situation and I've seen someone who at some point, oh my God, I haven't seen that person for 10 years, I don't want to see them. Because they this or that, you know. It's like just sitting in the middleness with it and letting it play out. So interesting where it goes. The aversion, the averting, the rousing of all of the energies that have to do with the association, and then following it from there, and maybe even the little story, if you just let it rip, about how to get even with the person, you know, who, I don't know, looked cross-eyed at me 10 years ago. As we become more familiar with this process, we play with it. We become interested. Okay, here's a moment of discomfort, of pain, reactivity, of fear, anger, and we become interested, and we allow for it in our daily lives, just kind of play itself out. There's enough spaciousness and stillness, and the inherent underlying characteristic of insight, anatta, that begins to allow for the ability to recognize something and see it in its life and all of its forms without causing any harm to oneself or to another. This is one of the ways that we can use our practice. I learned very early in my practice, and when I was invited, I was mentored to teach, you know, that I very much wanted to spend time with people as much as in retreat, in the subtleties of the physics of practice and how it relates, interfaces with the sense of self, but also just, you know, here and now. How is here and now sitting here in the sacred space truly any different It's through association that we make it different. And this is positive association. I didn't remember the first time I came through the door, but I remember the second time to stop and cultivate mudita. Did anybody who's here remember? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we forget and we remember. We forget and remember. I was so grateful when I remembered. Because what was on my mind when I came in the door was, oh, I saw Fred's face in the doorway, and I thought Fred, rather than mudita. Because I wanted to say to Fred, thank you. Which isn't, you know, not a bad trade-off. Because, you know, and I wanted to tell him how impressed I was, because he seems to know, you know, the layout and the logistics where am I? Albuquerque, you know, like the Buddha knew the path of Dhamma. You know, he just said, oh, I know where you are in this and this and this and this and this. So, but next time I went out and came through, I thought, oh, yes. Mudita. And paused. Paused. A lot of great gratitude for remembering. And there's this kind of, I'm going to say, gentleness that comes into our practice that isn't about rigid standards of how it should be. Because that's the tyranny of what we call ego, that kind of the guardian of fear and aversion, which is ego. If you really tune in, you know, to what fear is saying and aversion is saying, it's a hard, harsh master. And we learn to let it evaporate, to feel the pain, but to choose to cultivate something else. And then from here, from that choice, then there's an openness that allows for us to be grateful for all the conditioning that arises that we're trying to suppress. Oh my goodness, suppress. Rather than appreciate. Be grateful for, because it's in awareness. When I realized that I liked mafia movies, I always liked mafia movies, you know, The Godfather. Give me more. It was because I didn't realize it at first, but I was curious about that mind. Right? The mafia mind. It's like, what? Really? Okay. All this love that leads to violence. All this sense of, you know, whatever. I just thought, there's duality. I didn't realize that why I was curious, because I hadn't tuned into the duality that expresses itself here in light and dark. And so I used to enjoy watching the light and dark flicker back and forth, you know, within that confused illusion about family and all that. And I have found my mafia mind. If you understand what I'm saying, I have found the hindrances. I have understood what's operating and how they can work together and how they can confuse us. So much of that which is suffering and that which is expresses as suffering and harming is simply confusion. The Dalai Lama does not believe he has any enemies, because no one in truth is capable of harm, really. Not in truth, not at the level of inherent tenderness. We're just very confused. Somebody comes along and says, I know what's good and bad. You know, and you go, really? Okay, and this is bad and that's good. We get confused. And we're unbinding this confusion. And we're unbinding it at a foundational level by providing the conditions that allow for the clarity, that allows us to see the forms of suffering that do exist, rather than suppressing them. There's a distinction between volitionary restraint and suppression. Volitionary restraint is where something is arising. The knowing itself knows that it is suffering, and there is instead of opening to it rather than a closing down. This is why in the metta practice, when we begin out of the concentration of metta with oneself, begin to include what's called the breaking down the barriers, so that we can really, really begin to invite into that purified consciousness that we cultivate first with ourselves through concentration. We begin to allow all the categories of inner being in life into this purified consciousness until we realize that we don't have any enemies. We make special, we make enemy, we make this, we make that, we make it all up by projecting. So the beauty of what we are engaging today, and again, because it's so boring, you know, in a way, I'm playing, to just sit here, you know, and then restlessness comes up, and, oh no, I'm not allowed to get up and move, I'm a good yogi, you know. I mean, to really see what's going on here, when we stay with continuity, and then we embody that continuity as we did, and we study the continuity, and we become more thorough and patient with the continuity, like as we did before we transitioned to standing and walking and enjoying. I hope you enjoyed your lunch. I hope that the enjoyment was in part just the willingness to experience it as it is. I have a friend who discovered when she was 40 years old on a retreat that she didn't like cheese. She had been raised in France, where everybody eats cheese. And she had an identification with being raised in France. She felt very proud about it. And so she would buy cheese and eat cheese. And she discovered she didn't like it. And she said at the end of the reading, "I don't like cheese. I don't know why I've been eating it all these years. It's slimy and it smells bad." And I said, "Well, gee, even though you don't like cheese, I do. Maybe I'll eventually not like cheese." But it was just that there's so much that opens up within us that it's just incidental. It's not about something extraordinary. All because we can tolerate or choose to tolerate one moment of receptivity within the sensory process of breathing. It's all right here. The Dhamma is all right here in this moment. So we can continue to cultivate patience and tolerance with the continuity of practice. Do you understand a little bit more about what's meant by that since our morning reflections? So simple, isn't it? Can we allow it to be this simple? I don't know, maybe. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And then we have questions along the way that come up about how this, whatever it is that this relates to the practice, and this is the role of teachers, you know, people who can recognize the underlying cause and effect and respond in terms of how to view and to process the experience in terms of skill and means. One of the skill and means that we can invite into this afternoon, if we choose, as well as the attitude of patience and the power that we have seen that it brings to our willingness for the tolerance and continuity of mindfulness, we can also bring in that note of affection. And it's not I being affectionate, but if there's patience, we understand what affection is. And not as a personal emotion, because we're all confused about this. We're not developing personal emotions. Effectively, in Buddhist perspective, there aren't emotions. There's that which moves, there's motion, but it's sensation and energy associated with different mind states and how we identify with them. And I'll have a lot of students who are therapists because that cutting line of, you know, reframing what this is, from emotion and the origin of emotion and what's really going on is a very interesting process, whether we're a therapist or not. But, you know, just that sense of that we associate that maybe kindness, metta's emotion, is something we become. The most that we can be and not become is that which is. We can't become anything. Because it's already here. It's already here. This is the fortuitous arising. It's all right here. And what we can do is recognize what we can cultivate. And then as in recognizing, if we try to claim it as ours and mine, and I'm going to be this way in this being as a result of it, then we're confused. And of course we're confused. Of course, we all want to be, I don't know, nice people? I don't know, how would you put it? What do you want to be? It isn't our personhood that's really going to change, it's that we're going to cultivate different factors. And if we try to claim them as ours, then they're not going to work for us in the way that consciousness of certain qualities in response to other qualities inherent within states of mind will work. So this afternoon, what I'm saying really is that if anybody here has, how many people here have cultivated metta? Oh, okay. You've cultivated metta? Oh, okay. Anybody here not familiar with metta? Metta as a word? As a practice? Okay. So it's an attitude. It exists as a potential within patience. It's a response to restlessness in correspondence with patience. It's a response. And then as restlessness proliferates into anger, Kanti, patience is still the response until it hits under the category of what's called doses or aversive states, ill will. Have you been able to identify ill will separate from anger? It has a certain, you know, it has a certain flavor, it has a certain proliferation of thinking, certain patterns of thinking, you know. So metta is for that unconscious process of confusion within our conditioning that ill will is somehow inappropriate cultivation. Because it doesn't make sense to not like that which you don't want within that view. If you don't like what you don't want a lot, isn't it going to go away? Isn't that one experiment? If I hate it, maybe it'll even go away further. So from here, it makes a little bit more sense about how we're including everything. The part of our inherent nature. Patience is allowing, is that openness rather than closing. And within that, then there's much more of a direct experience of the energies associated with various states. And then we hear the teaching that all of these conditions are seeds in the heart. No one exempt. No one exempt. All the wholesome seeds and all the unwholesome seed. Each being equally distributed. Each being living out of some degree of clarity and of intention and greater degree of lack of clarity and delusion. So when we sit with the appreciation of the simple practice, with this understanding, that we don't have to fight against anything, that it's not necessary, and that it's just a confusion of response, of reaction, then we can allow for ourselves, as a result of the humility, to recognize, yeah, I think I'll cultivate one of these seeds. that exists within this consciousness that just hasn't yet been given attention, like a seed in a pot. I was walking there and seeing all these pots that are going to have beautiful plants. They're going to emerge, you know, if there's water, you know, in the springtime. Grass grows in the springtime. And one of these seeds that we can cultivate that's inherent, that's part of our nature, is this seed of loving kindness. And it's not an emotion. It's not a feel-good thing. We do feel better when we cultivate metta, but the betterness within it is because it is lawful. It is in harmony with our nature, as opposed to disharmony. There's so many correlations that I need to use volitional restraint and not take up any more time. And for those who might be interested in coming tomorrow, we can look more at correlations and how things work, you know, from our own practice base. It's very interesting to do that. But for now, what I'd like to say is that if you like to bring your metta practice in through skillful use of mind to the practice of establishing a foundation of mindfulness through the awareness of sensation and through the continuity in tolerating cessation for a present cessation, I said, I meant sensation, tolerating it at the edges of thinking. If you want to continue with that to build up the patience and the tolerance and the clarity of that juncture, that is a forever skillful choice, because this is foundational. If you'd like to invite the metta practice, if you've practiced it, if you've not, then this is another day. But to come in, to realize what you're doing is inviting it through the mind door. Because we've been working within the sensory vedana, sensation and energy door, contact awareness door. And that you're inviting the metta, which is a mental formation, through the mind door, and you are aligning your intention in the awareness of the body sitting here and breathing with this and inviting it, so that essentially each breath is dedicated to the metta. Life is dedicated to the metta. You don't have to stay in particular specific continuity with breathing, although it might keep coming back in. You offer it instead to the metta object. Is that clear? In which case you build continuity with the phrase is. You've not been using the mind door. We've been using and familiarizing with the foundation. We want to get here finally in life. We want to come home, don't we? We want to bring our attention back where it's at home. And then from here, we can begin to recognize the skillful use of mentality. Said that metta is the highest cognitive use of mind, meaning the cognitive forms, thought, the words and the thoughts aren't thought, they're just used as an object. And that it works as a lightning rod, doesn't it? Takes all the static, like that. We just get all that into continuity with the metta. So, if you see this as an extension of your practice today, you know, then perhaps you'd like to experiment from this point of view. I personally am going to continue clarifying foundation and sensation and the receptivity, and that's a lifelong dedication. And since metta comes a lot right now in the consciousness naturally, and I can focus it when I choose, I think that what is most healthy for me today is to really, really build more concentration into embodiment. You assess for yourself. It's said that the Buddha is the doctor, these practices are medicines, and we are the nurses administering these medicines. Choose for yourself. Just as the Buddha says, know for yourself what is true. Choose for yourself what would be truly helpful to you.